documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, your host here for the next 3 hours, along with Vicki Davis. Nice to have you with us once again as we document the crisis of our republic, the undermining of our national, state, and individual autonomy. Today is the 2nd of September 2017, and here we are again, another action-packed week. And good morning, Vicki. How you doing?
Good morning, Darren. Just fine, thank you.
As usual, we're flying by the seat of our pants. Seems like no matter
well,
how many hours...
nobody does it better than you. So
well, that's very kind of you to say. Nobody, it seems like no matter how many hours are in the week, I never feel ready when showtime comes.
It's funny, oh, I know.
Funny how that works. Anyway, what's been going on other than massive hurricanes and... mobs of angry people, and I don't even think half of them know what they're angry about, but
no,
we have angry people.
I do. I know why I'm angry.
Well, you know, yeah, but you're not a mob. Maybe you should become a mob.
Yeah, that's kind of unfortunate. or maybe it's fortunate, I guess, if you had the clones of me out there, all in one bunch. Boy, it'd be bad.
Well, we haven't quite been trying to incite a mob, but we have been trying to rally the troops to around the idea that, hey, freedom is worth protecting. Once gone, it's very hard to get back.
Yeah, and the condition that our country is in is proof positive of that.
Absolutely. So... what's been what have you been working on? Anything in particular?
Well, yeah, I got an article that was very upsetting to me. Somebody sent me a link to an article. The title of it is "White House Wants to Help States and Cities to Offload Infrastructure."
Oh, more privatization.
Yeah, and that's coming from the Transportation Department, and I've written quite a few articles about Elaine Chao because of this. I consider her to be a foreign agent of China. Maybe a month or two ago, when they were talking about the transportation budget, she did talk about... getting foreign direct investment, or at least she mentioned it. She caught herself, but she did mention it.
Yeah, did we play that audio on the show?
I think we did, yeah.
Yeah, seems like I remember that.
Yeah, but recently they had a meeting. It was Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao and the White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. Mm-hmm. Told about 150 transportation officials at the White House that they want the private sector to play a bigger role in managing and financing public infrastructure. Well, you know that all the money for public infrastructure, the roads and bridges and so forth, they don't need the extra money to build the actual roads and bridges. What they need that money for is for the fusion centers and the police state surveillance technology.
Yeah, I don't know why people keep falling for this idea that privatization is a good thing. I mean, I guess it's because the government can't run anything very effectively. Although there are... either way, we're going to pay for it.
But I think the government would run things... just fine if the Congress would just leave them alone and let them do the job they gave them to do. But so often what Congress does is that it adds, you know, ridiculous things in there for them to do. When the party in power... writes legislation and they're writing it for an agency that the other party created, they can just as well write legislation to damage the agency as well as to make it more efficient. And I think this battle between the red hats and the blue hats has been going on for so long that they've just totally screwed up everything.
Yeah, well, anytime you have the government become as big and powerful as it is, then you're going to have problems. You're going to have inefficiencies. You're going to have red tapes. And it's going to be something that's unmanageable. I mean, the larger any organization, and that's the same, I guess, for the corporate world as well. Although there's an...
Well, not so much for the corporate
world. There's a monetary incentive in the corporate world to try to, you know, deal with problems. In government,
well,
it seems like...
your job is on the line.
That's right.
In a private corporation, if you don't do your job, you're out.
You're out, yeah, generally speaking. And there are some poorly run corporations as well, to be sure. But in the public sector, it seems like they just ask for more money. They ask for more appropriations.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. The worse the agency is run, the more money they get.
Yeah, yeah.
And... so, but I found something interesting in doing another line of research. During the Reagan administration, when they were deregulating and taking the government apart that way.
The hands-off approach.
Right. Reagan signed an executive order, I think it was EO-12291. Requiring a cost-benefit analysis on everything, every regulation, including the regulations that are made for reasons that are intangible. You know, like clean air, clean water. You can't put a dollar value on that. And when you try to put a dollar value on an intangible, basically you're writing fiction.
Yeah.
And that was really, at the time, I mean, look where it's gotten us. We've got a whole world society discussing climate change. Climate change is a fiction.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and boy, are they pushing climate change. Which brings us back to the hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
The media, of course, used the opportunity... created by this whole thing to push the agenda of sustainable development big time. MSNBC had Rick Stengel on, and according to Wikipedia, looked him up. He was the Time Magazine's 16th managing editor. He wrote a book in collaboration with Nelson Mandela, just to give you an idea how connected he is. He was a State Department official under the Obama administration. So, again, he's really connected. He lays the problem of Houston's flood at the hands of the local officials, who he says aren't regulating people enough.
One area that I will take issue with, and at the risk of being a skunk at the picnic, when he said, Houston's going to build bigger and better than ever. Part of the problem with Harvey, like Katrina, is these are man-made disasters in part, because the thousands and thousands of buildings that have been built in Houston on floodplains, on 100-year floodplains over the last 10 years, these are problems of public officials and unregulated expansion that has made these areas vulnerable. To me, it's not about building bigger and better. It's about building to a 500 or 1,000-year plan the way Amsterdam is and other cities that are threatened like this. Right. This is a problem of public servants.
You have to look at it, but one of the things, I mean, if we look at New Orleans, it's under sea level. New Orleans is protected by those dikes.
But
and that's the way it was
the
built.
The Army Corps of Engineers built them to a too low standard.
That's those things have to be looked at and done. I don't dispute that, but we do have some cities, very big cities right now, and you can't just say we're going to shut down Houston, we're going to shut down New Orleans.
I'm not
got to figure
you shut
out
it down. I'm saying you build it to protect the people.
And hopefully we'll be learning from this, as we hopefully learn from Katrina, because the biggest problem in Katrina was those dikes.
Yeah, those dikes, which were blown by the Army Corps of Engineers. According to the eyewitnesses that were down there.
Isn't it interesting that he's saying we can't live with any risk, but then on refugee resettlement, oh, it's just a risk we have to live with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's schizophrenic.
Yeah,
is what it
yeah.
is.
Well, you know. But, you know, the thing is that the answer to everything is more regulation. The answer to everything is more control. More control of private property. That's always the go-to answer to everything. More government. You haven't got enough government in your life.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and more surveillance.
Yeah. Which is more government.
Well, no.
Yeah, not necessarily, maybe.
The fusion centers are public-private.
Yeah, well, there you go. I stand corrected. Governance is what I should have said.
That partnership thing comes in real handy.
I should have said governance.
Yes.
But MSNBC continued. They were another session. They had Kaya Collier on. Now, she's an environmental reporter for the Texas Tribune. And guess what? Again, the problem is human activity and urban sprawl.
You know, it all went downhill from there pretty much.
You actually have given a lot of thought to this and a lot of research to this because you co-wrote a joint Tribune ProPublica report in December on Houston and its potential for catastrophic flooding. And I want to read just a little bit of it. You wrote, as millions have flocked to the metropolitan area in recent decades, local officials have largely snubbed stricter building regulations, allowing developers to pave over crucial acres of prairie land that once absorbed huge amounts of rainwater. As people move forward in the months going ahead, once the immediate threat of loss of life passes by, what will they find? How big a role does this loss of prairie land play in the city's inability to drain away rainwater and to cause the kind of massive, first of all, life-threatening conditions as well as huge financial losses that we're seeing here?
Yeah, according to a lot of the scientists we talk to, every scientist we talk to, experts and some public officials, a lot of this devastation could have been prevented if Houston officials over the decades had been willing to have smarter development policies, leave some green space instead of paving it over with concrete.
Green space.
And having all this impervious cover just means that people get flooded out as the water drains off to whatever natural kind of form of, you know, a creek or a bayou, and eventually drains out to the Gulf of Mexico. But local officials that we talked to said, you know, the argument by scientists that, you know, this prairie land would absorb a bunch of rainwater is, you know, ludicrous, it's absurd, and, you know, we can essentially fight concrete with concrete. We can, you know, through these massive public works projects that mitigate flooding, you know, retention ponds, widening the bayou system, that kind of thing. And, you know, some of that might be needed, but scientists are saying what's really needed is smarter development policy.
Scientists are saying it's those science, you know, it's probably those same 97% scientists that are always saying, global warming is real, right? These imaginary scientists.
The same ones that write the fiction.
Yeah, phantom scientists.
For several months now.
Ah, come on now.
And for public officials to start thinking about climate change and how climate change will start bringing more intense and frequent rainfall. And there, a lot of them are not doing that at this point, even though a bunch of other major cities are.
Well, anyone who takes a look at that report that you did with ProPublica will see it is alarmingly prophetic.
Alarmingly prophetic. So, yeah, they're very active.
Uh-huh.
The thing is
just, you know, build high rises and bridges at the top of the high rise so that people never touch the ground.
Well, no, we just got to go through and shoot all the people. That's
that's
the problem is people.
They're putting stadiums everywhere, so.
Well, there's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do because here's the thing. Okay, let's say we do what this woman advocates. We have large swaths of prairie land in the middle of the city. Okay, sounds great. People have a place to go. The mosquitoes have a place to breed. You know, and all will be well with wildlife. Okay, that sounds great. But what occupied that space? People occupied that space. So what's going to live there? Where are the people going to go?
Well, the animals just get run over, you know. is what happens to the animals. If you encourage animals in a city, close to a city area, then...
But my point is that by taking out buildings where people occupy, where people live, where people work, where people do their thing, whatever that thing might happen to be, people are going to have to go somewhere if they still exist. So we know that urban sprawl isn't an option. They don't want us to sprawl because, well, then you're expanding the city borders into the rural areas, and that's no good. So what do they want you to do? What are you?
Go away.
Go away. That's it. Cease to exist. They're never going to be happy because they don't want people. This is an anti-people agenda.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's the whole, all of the policies for climate change are suicidal. It's national suicide, national economic suicide. It's suicidal for people. It'll get worse, you know, as they keep squeezing and squeezing, you know, where you can't afford your air conditioning anymore, and people die because of the heat, and, you know, they or freeze because they can't afford the electricity for the heat. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I don't know where all of this is going.
You know, years ago, and in fact, it was January 1999, to be exact, there was a document that was put out, and I used to cite this all the time on the broadcast back years ago, and I got away from it because after a while of talking about these natural disasters, you tend to say the same thing over and over again, and it gets a little bit laborious. But since it's been a while, I want to share a little of this document with the people out there. It was a Sustainable Development and Natural Hazards Mitigation. This was a document that was put out by the Mitigation Planning Initiative Group, a Division of Emergency Management, North Carolina Department of Crime Control and Public Safety in Raleigh, North Carolina. And there's a whole lot of, and there is also the Department of City and Regional Planning, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And so they talk about how, what a wonderful opportunities that sustainable, these natural disasters create.
Oh, sure. It's part of the global Marshall Plan. Mm-hmm. You know, a disaster is an opportunity to rebuild sustainably.
Yeah, they say the United States of America is fast growing beyond its limits. Our growth acclimated society has exceeded the Earth's capacity to sustain us while we continue to follow a growth at all costs lifestyle. I disagree with that.
Well, why do they, if that's true, why do they keep bringing people in at the rate of over a million a year or more?
See, this is the thing. If, now, I don't doubt there's overcrowding in cities in certain places. I don't doubt that there are problems. People talk about overpopulation. But the problem isn't that there's too many people. The problem is you have inadequate infrastructure, perhaps, to handle the people you have. And as you pointed out, which is a great point, why keep bringing more people in then if you think there's too many people? I mean, get in an airplane and fly over much of the country, and you're going to look down most of the time and see green. You're going to see large swaths of land that are unoccupied all over the globe, regardless of where you are and where you happen to be flying over. The sole exception are large cities. So, yes, the cities may have a problem, but to suggest that we can't deal with that with infrastructure, I think is tomfoolery.
Yeah. Well, everybody's got an agenda, you know.
Yeah. So they say, clearly these patterns of consumption and overuse are unsustainable. Many believe we are approaching a point of no return in our relationship with the Earth. There are also those who believe that our current patterns of behavior regarding natural resources are a derelict of duty, a duty which is imposed on all living things to live within the carrying capacity of their environment. These unsustainable patterns permeate nearly every aspect of our collective lives. Excuse me, people, I don't have a collective life.
But I was just thinking that exact same thing.
I am an individual, thank you. But we are even transgressing the limits placed upon us by the natural world in our choices of habitat, and have pushed development into areas which are inappropriate or dangerous for human settlement. Human activity is routinely located so that it creates a serious threat to ourselves, as well as a wide variety of natural resources and functions, many of which are beneficial to people as well as valuable in and of themselves as part of the interrelated living ecosystem. Level, dry, and stable condition sites are long gone, Vicky, in many communities. Yet the pressure to build more commercial venues, production facilities, employment centers, and residential units continues to be steady and strong in much of the country. Woe is us.
Well, yeah, you know, and isn't it interesting that we know it's really not true of the United States. It is perhaps true in China and India that they are overpopulated and don't have infrastructure to handle their population. Many people, you know, I don't know if they have enough food. I assume that they do. But why don't they take their report and go report over there and leave us alone, you know?
Well, because we're the ones they're trying to control.
If I conserve some water, it's not going to help anybody. It's not going to help those people over there.
Well, yeah, if you conserve water, and see, that's the thing. Out there where you are, you might need to conserve some water.
Because Idaho has lots of water. Lots and lots of water.
Well, you're nearby areas that don't. But, I mean, the thing is that here in Michigan, I don't know why they would ever need to conserve any water. We've got so much water around here that the mosquitoes are killing us. You know, I don't think we need to conserve any water. But the thing is it's about control. And
yes,
generally,
that's really
there are solutions to just about every problem if you really put your mind to it. Controlling people does not have to be the fallback for everything. It drives me bonkers. I tell you what, we got a call on the line. By the way, folks, you're welcome to call in if you would like. 844-646-8376. Toll free, 844-6-GOVERN. That's 844-646-8376. I'll get back to this ridiculous document in a moment. But first, let's go to Dallas. And hello, come on in. You're on the air.
What a timely topic.
Yeah.
The article you just read talked about our relationship with the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I should have got out a prenuptial agreement ahead of time.
You're bad.
You know,
well stated.
And it is true. A lot of our more developed, sustainably developed cities, they're all next to rivers or waterways of some type. You know, before the interstate system, you know, that's how you received and delivered goods.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Now, what
yes.
they've done, though, what they go ahead, Vic. I'm sorry.
No, she's agreeing with you.
I was just agreeing with you.
Yeah, but the thing is, they've gotten so large, and it's not really it's the government driving the development instead of the development driving government. I believe because you know, for years growing up, we all had golf courses around us, but they were all built in floodplains. You had to drive your car to the golf course. Well, the city's got a little hard up for money. You know, it's kind of like the state. They hate gambling until they run short on funds, and all of a sudden the lottery looks real good. But the cities decided, wow, think of the property taxes we could get if we put houses on a golf course. So they go, and these houses, by the way, are usually not multi-apartment, you know, these are houses.
Mm-hmm.
And they just collect tons of property taxes off of these developments. And, of course, they're more likely to prone than any other area around you.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But they like the property taxes. And then when it floods, we all get to pay. But the cities walk away with the cash.
Yeah.
Well,
so
we all get to pay.
I'm looking.
But what do you mean by we all get to pay? You mean higher flood insurance?
We all get to pay through insurance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Socialized recovery programs.
But unless you live in a floodplain, which unfortunately more and more people do because these maps are constantly being redrawn, I don't even know that I could get flood insurance.
Oh, you could. The insurance company will always take your money, especially if they're not likely to have to pay out.
Yeah, I guess. The National Flood Insurance... See, I don't know, because as I recall, I researched this at one point. Let me... Go ahead, Mark. I'm going to look dig something up here.
No, but it's, you know, I'm seeing this all the time. And then, you know, with the Cajun Navy coming in, they were here 2 days. I think before it even reached Washington, they, you know, parts of Texas was flooding. So the Cajun Navy shows up. You couldn't see a sheriff, a policeman. You couldn't see anything down there, but just a bunch of, you know, good old boys out there in their boats trying to go get people, because it is well known that up until about 72 or so hours after you lose electricity and everything, everybody's pretty much calm, cool, and collected. But after about 3 days or whatever, people start going off the edge.
Mm-hmm.
You don't show up a week after this, you know, with hell and high water flying everywhere with a bunch of helicopters and stuff. You have to get enough to get going. That cannot be done by government. The first responders was the Cajun Navy and the Texas Alamo Flotilla.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
Hold
your thoughts. Keep your thoughts in place. Let me hold you over the break, okay?
Okay, buddy. Thanks.
Yeah, hang on just a second. Folks, we'll be back here in a moment. We're already at the bottom of the hour. Stay tuned. And by the way, it's 844-646-8376. If you got anything to add, that's 844-6-GOVERN. We'll be back. Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com is the website. GovernAmerica.com. And Vicky's websites are TheTechnocraticTyranny.com, TheTechnocraticTyranny.com, and also ChannelingReality.com. And she is a contributor to The Voice of Idaho, TVOINews.net. And we're talking about the control of the population as the control of land, flood insurance. And one of the things that I was referring to just a moment ago was this. I made the statement that I'm not sure that I could even get flood insurance, because I was remembering something I had researched several years ago, and I've referred to this article numerous times over the years. It's one I wrote, Controlling the Land by Soaking the People. You can't get flood insurance unless your community contributes or participates in the National Flood Insurance Program. And that participation, it requires your local government officials to adopt certain very stringent restrictions upon the land. Certain ordinances that control the property and how certain things should be done. So that's why I made that statement that I don't know if it's even available here, because the National Flood Insurance Program is administered by FEMA. Now, insurance companies sell supplemental flood insurance, but you have to, unless it's changed since I did my research, you have to get your primary flood insurance from the NFIP. So anyway, I wanted to make that distinction. Anyway, we have Mark in Texas on the line right now. And Mark had to very rudely cut you off there. You remember what you were going to say?
Fine. Not a problem. I need to take a breath anyway. I ain't talked this much in a long time. I had a chance to watch quite a bit of the coverage. and I was watching CNN one day, and they had one of the CNN reporters on the front of a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And it was its private boat. What police, what sheriff, what marshal, what National Guard, what Texas Guard, wasn't anybody, it wasn't the Navy. It was just some old guy out there in his boat. Anyway, they pull up this one house because they hear this gal screaming. Well, actually yelling for help. And so they pull up, and the guy gets out of the boat. The owner gets out of the boat, walks up, knocks on the door shelf. She looks to be like in her mid-50s. She goes, well, I need some help. And he goes, well, there's been boats coming up and down here all day long. Why didn't you flag one down? Now, this lady has her mother and father there. Mother's got dementia. Father looks like he's in his 80, late 80s also. He can barely get around. She goes, now, this is the unredeemable people I'm fixing to tell you about. She answered back to him why she didn't go ahead and allow one of the other boats that had been coming down all day long. She was waiting for the National Guard. Now, I'm not real big on the phrase unredeemable, considering where it come from, you know, in the national media, but there it applies.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it reminds me of that story. You remember, I don't know, you may have heard it before, the joke people tell about somebody standing on the roof of their house, and along comes a helicopter or a boat and says, I want to, you know, rescue you. And they say, no, I'm waiting on God. And then along comes, you know, a helicopter, you know, loudspeaker, you know, let's rescue you. And I'm paraphrasing here. I don't remember exactly how the thing went. But they call out to him, and he says, no, I'm waiting on God, you know. And then because, well, anyways, it's like three different methods of rescue come along, and every time they refuse them, and finally the person drowns. And when they stand before God at the pearly, you know, enter the pearly gates, and they're standing at the throne of God, and God, he says, God, I don't understand, you know, I mean, I was relying upon you to rescue me, and I drown. And God says, you know, who do you think sent the helicopter and the boat? And, he can only do so much. So it's kind of like that.
There was some of the other footage. I won't take much more time. Just one more. There was another some footage. There was a policeman run out of gas, and this is like the third day, and he was in one of those center console. Looks like kind of similar to a Boston Whaler, if y'all know what that is. But anyhow, he's out of gas. So just a civilian, you know, in a pickup, pulls down to the water's edge and gets his 5-gallon plastic gas can out and hands it to the police officer so he could get enough gas to, I guess, go about his business, whatever. But anyway, it had the gas can. You knew it wasn't official because it was old, but it was one that you pull a white flexible nozzle out of it. You undo the cap, and then you pull this nozzle out. Mm-hmm. Well, you're supposed to stick that in the hole of the tank, the gas tank, mm-hmm. then turn the bottle up, you know, so you don't spill anything.
Right, like I did yesterday.
What's this experienced professional do? He lays it horizontally next to the hole and picks up the can. Now, he doesn't even stuff it in the hole. He holds it up. Now, this boat is yawing just a little bit, you know. There's more gas going in the bottom of the boat. The only time this professional ever filled up that boat was at a gas station.
Yep.
He didn't even know how to use a regular landscaper's plastic gas can.
Yeah.
These are the people that we're waiting to rescue us.
Well, I'm surprised he even showed up, you know, because, with all the committee hearings that you have to attend, in order to decide who's going to go where, and, you know, the bureaucratic red tape, I'm surprised that they're even there.
Well, and with this whole, you know, that the emergency response isn't just national, it's international. And there was a fire a few years ago, and they were flying in forest firefighters from different places around in the world. A firefighter was complaining about that. You know, he said they don't know the terrain. They don't know anything about our area.
Yeah,
and they probably don't even speak English.
Yeah, right. You know, firefighters from Guatemala.
Yeah, makes
or somewhere like that. You know,
it makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Well, that's global systems, global governance,
yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
What were you saying, Mark?
Everybody is equivalent. All you need is that certificate.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
Most of these old boys that have had boats for any length of time, they can replace a lower unit. In other words, what I'm talking about, the boats that got tore up hitting a brick mailbox or, you know, something else under the water they couldn't see, because they were drafting in pretty shallow water. Anyway, most of them did have props. They could usually do the lower unit as far as a replacement if it gets tore up. But one thing very few people, if any, can do other than a real professional is balance a prop. Mm. So if anybody down in the Houston area marine shop that's still open, I can't tell people what to do, but you know, if you could give them boys a break on balancing and repairing the prop, that'd probably be a good thing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because I know there's a lot of it tore up down there. There has to be. Now, a question for y'all, and then I'm going to let you go.
Okay.
I keep coming up with more stuff. We talked about price gouging down here.
Right.
There's a big thing. In fact, the Attorney General come out, Paxton, he's saying that, you know, $4 is the limit. That's as much as you can charge without getting in trouble with the state.
Okay.
You know, which I'm sure that $4 fluctuates with the normal price. But anyway, we won't go there. Sounds like a can.
$4
to me. But
$4 for gas, you mean?
For a gallon of gas.
Yeah,
anything
okay.
above that would be considered gouging.
Okay.
Now, how he come up with a $4, who knows?
Yeah, that's arbitrary.
Yeah, very much, very much. Adjustable daily, by the way. But here's the thing. Let's say you're a gas owner and you're an independent, and you went in debt for to buy the gas station.
Sure.
Now, you hadn't had electricity in 3 days, but it did finally come back on.
Okay.
You have no food to sell, except for Twinkies and Ding Dongs, you know, stuff in packages, because everything that was refrigerated, for the most part, has probably spoiled.
Perished, of course, naturally.
Now, you don't make a huge markup on gas anyway.
No, pennies.
One thing that remains constant is a $3,500 note payment you have to make every month.
And your property taxes.
Would it be gouging if... Oh, property taxes. It's lakefront property now, by the way. But if you wanted to turn the electricity off to your gas pumps, because you finally got electricity back, but you ain't got no food coming, that's a given. You know, trucks can't get in there. But anyway, you got electricity. So you put white bags over your gas nozzles, and you turn the electricity off to the pumps, under the impression that now you are out of gas, where you underground storage containers are about three-quarters full. You know the gas is going to go up. You say you don't have any. You wait till gas goes up, and then you sell what you have to help make your payment.
Yeah.
Now, is that price gouging, or is that buy low, sell high?
No, now you're a hoarder. Now you're hoarding. You're like one of those preppers that they show on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're one of those evil hoarders, and now we've got a seizure gas station, you know, and it's got to be governmentized. I'm being facetious, of course. But that's probably what they'd say next.
Yeah. It's just something to think about, though, because it's not really hoarding. You're just letting the market take its course and then selling high. And every retailer...
Yeah, but we don't have a free market anymore, Mark. We don't have a free market.
Well, we don't.
You're one of those evil profiteers.
We have a centrally planned economy, and so that gas station owner is connected into the supply chain of the oil companies. So
he's living in the past.
So there's no real need to worry about his bottom line because he's not us anymore. The days of the old, you know, single owner gas station are pretty much over.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Well, there's a few of them around still, but they're certainly an endangered species.
Absolutely.
They're dinosaurs.
Yeah.
They used to have a lot of refineries. They're pretty much in one basket now, also. That's what's giving us the problem we got.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. I was watching a video.
Hey, thanks, Mark.
One of the leading central planners of the economy, and he was talking about Houston used to be a big refining town, but it became a tech town. Hmm. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, yeah, that's Enron was from Houston, right?
Yeah. And it's Enron also that, Ken Lay, who I never really, I'm suspicious that he never really died.
I'm sure he didn't.
I never believed that he really died. His death was very timely, and the judge expunged the charges against him after he died, which was equally, when does this ever happen?
That was so that the record would be cleared, case closed. And
well, we don't want
got reincarnated.
We don't want the deceased actually being marred by a record, now, do we?
Yeah.
So just don't tell me that money doesn't buy you influence. Anyway, but he was the guy with Al Gore that came up with this cap and trade bull crap after defrauding all of his people. You know, and why doesn't anybody ever talk about this?
Well, Ken Lay was a regulator.
Oh, he was. Ken Lay was a lot of things.
Right. And, well, Enron really was not. He started out with a gas company, as CEO of a gas company. And then they merged with another company up north. Anyway, ultimately, the whole Enron was an asset light company, meaning they really owned nothing. It was just a tech company. It was just a an electricity trading system.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the regulators who set up the regulations so that they could do it. It all started with natural gas. And the government had regulated natural gas so that in such a way that...
Boy, Skype is really treating you poorly today.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know if it's on my end or your end or somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I don't know. But, well, anyway, the thing is that the gas market was rigged, and it was when they deregulated it, they set it up so that you could have a gas bank, natural gas bank, that would be the middleman between the distributors and the suppliers and the distributors. And so you know, he went into business after he was involved in the regulation of it. So
yeah, well, and that's pretty common, and that's part of the problem, is it turns into a good old boys club. You know, we see the same thing with the pharmaceutical industry. We see the same thing in just about every industry. It's almost like they're regulating themselves.
Yeah, well, they are. Ultimately, the whole deal with self-regulation is that...
Maybe that's what they mean by self-government.
It is. People think that they're talking about regular people and our historical ideas of self-government, you know, Republican government and all of that. No. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about
the
corporations
elite.
Being self-regulatory.
Yeah, the elite are regulating themselves. They're governing themselves.
Yeah.
That's what the new 21st century definition of government: of the people, by the people, for the people. We're not the people. They are the people.
Right, we're not. And if there are multiple businesses, then there's an association that is supposed to provide the, quote, best practices.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, operational guidelines and all of that. I don't know where anybody ever got the idea that corporations were paragons of virtue and integrity, because they're not. I guess, I don't know, maybe it's the...
Well, the boards of directors and the CEOs, they're the ones propagating the idea. So maybe
they hired good Madison Avenue people to
marketing.
To write the propaganda.
Tell you what, San Antonio, Texas, you're on the air.
Morning, Darren. Morning, Vicki.
Hi.
It's Alan.
Thanks for holding.
Yeah, well, I could go on a lot of things since I had my original thought. I always like hearing Mark. He always has good comments.
Yeah.
But, Yeah, it's with this Houston flood, though, I see a good opportunity for like the American Planning Association to exert their influence into this. And another thing local here that I saw that I've saw once again in our little weekly paper here is that we were a big tourist town, so we've got all these bed and breakfasts springing up everywhere. Of course, now the hotel owners are starting to complain, and the other B&B owners are starting to complain that, they don't have just the overload of business anymore. People are being able to select, what they like and stay at other places. So now they're going to, and neighbors are complaining because, they come in on the weekends and they're wild and crazy and disrupt the neighborhood. And so now they're going to create a new position and hire a new code enforcement person to go around, and you'll have to have a B&B license now. And the code enforcement officer will come around at least once a year to check and make sure that your B&B is in compliance with the standards that are being set by the people that want to come and buy our baubles.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, there's a town here in Idaho that, well, apparently there was some apartment share or apartment rent online facility where people from other countries or wherever could rent your apartment or your house for a weekend or a week or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's a town here in Idaho that passed an ordinance against letting people rent out their house via that online facility because the motel owners were complaining about it, apparently.
Well, I'm sure they'll probably introduce some new short-term sublet contract that the city will have control of and make money on, because you'll have to get licenses and fees and all the regulations and everything. Yeah, and the enforcement and the code guys coming around. Yeah, it's...
Well, maybe that's the key to the whole thing, is to make sure that the city or county gets their cut from the beginning, and then you won't have any problems. Just give them their payola to leave you alone.
Any way you look at it, the corruption is just creeping into every little tiny corner of every one of our lives.
That's true. And it reminds me also what you were talking about, the code enforcement officer of this International Property Maintenance Code from the International Code Council. Sam and Trish Britton, years ago, bought a copy of that so that we could all read it. And I would love to be able to post it on the internet. Unfortunately, it's copyrighted by the International Code Council. But this is a code that basically gives that code enforcement officer unbridled power to literally, essentially take your land. They don't say that right in there, but when he can fine you, he or she can fine you $1,000 a day on violations on your property for just minor things. Dented downspouts and chipped paint, whatever the case might happen to be. If they have a bad day or they just don't like you for whatever reason, they can fine you daily to the tune of $1,000. And it won't take long for that to add up to the point where, you might as well just forfeit your property. It is asset forfeiture. That's what...
Yeah.
It's regulatory racketeering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
It's one of those voluntary, involuntary things. We've involuntarily been volunteered into it. It's like, around here, out in the countryside, there are little, subdivisions and little communities. You can go out and this one of them is, you drive down a steep, steep up and down through the canyons, and you come out to it, and everyone out there has a PO, or in a POA. You can't just, you're out in the country, but you're limited as you can't park a trailer where you want it, anything else.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I just can't understand, why people would even want that. But I guess if you grew up in a big city, that would almost be paradise. At least you'd have the trees and everything around you. But it just baffles me.
I think a lot of people fall in love with homes, and I think there's a lot of problem with people not even realizing how bad that HOAs are. They fall in love with a property.
Yeah, exactly. Great little psychopaths, little control freaks everywhere just love that stuff.
Yeah, they're like parking meter maids. They get a little bit of power, and they can't handle the power. And hey, you know, I'm just going to dictate everything about your whole life. I had an Enron. I had a fight with a parking meter maid years ago when I was. And this is getting a little off topic, but I was actually driving a live truck for an NBC affiliate. We were going live. We were covering this parade down in the downtown area at the Capitol. And it was, I don't know, some kind of holiday thing, Thanksgiving or Christmas. I can't remember what. But anyway, we were down, I was given very, specific instructions by the assignment editor that this is where I was supposed to be on this particular street corner. So I was there, I was set up, had the mast in the air. Along comes this parking meter maid, and she says, "You got to move that van." And I says, "Well, this is where I was told to be." "No, no, 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 you can't park there. We nobody can park here. You got to move that van." So I says, "Well, so I called back to the station, and I said, "Hey, meter maid's along here, and she's driving her little scooter, and she's wanting me to move." And memo, the assignment editor says, "Under no circumstances are you to move that van. That is exactly where the city told us to be." And I said, "All right, fine, good for me." She says, "We'll take the ticket. Tell them we'll take the ticket." And so I told her when she came back, and said, "Why haven't you moved that van?" I says, "Well, I'm not moving the van. This is where they told us to be. We'll take the ticket." She says, "Well, that's not about ticket. You got to move that van." Barking orders at me. And so I went ahead. I had the mast in the air. I wasn't going to put it down. And she finally realized that I wasn't going to move. And so we had an anchor show up later on because we were doing the whole show from that particular street. And the anchor finally showed up, and she says, "You got to move that car. The van can stay, but you got to move the car." So he finally capitulated and moved the car and gave her the bone she wanted, I guess. But this is how these people are. I mean, they get a little power, and they think, I'm really somebody, and they're going to just push you around. And meter maids are one thing, but when you got these types of personalities that have sway over how you live, that are able to nitpick your property and dictate to you everything you're going to do on a daily basis based upon some private contract that you signed, that you have to sign in on condition of getting financed for a property, this is the problem. I think what needs to happen, and it's unfortunate that more people aren't aware of just how bad these things are, but people need to quit buying into homeowners associations. Just starve them out. That's really the only way you can kill them, is to starve them out. If enough people quit buying into these properties, then maybe some of these developers will quit bringing them in. And then the banks, if they won't be able to get people to take out loans in areas where these properties exist, that will decentivize the requirement they have that people sign the contract on the condition of mortgages.
Yeah, I don't know. Good luck with that one. They've been around for quite a while, and I don't know. I really kind of think that the cities make them set those up. Because there's really, what interest really does the developer have after he builds the property and sells it? And those homeowners associations are created as CC&Rs on the property.
Yeah. Hang on a second.
Something like
hang
that.
On a second, Alan and Vicky, we got to take a break here. Hold on, we'll be back.
The crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro-FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2, this is the second hour of Govern America. Darren Weeks and Vicki Davis here, as we are every Saturday, and continues to be the 2nd of September 2017, if I can spit it out here. And we're talking about the mess down in Texas with Hurricane Harvey, the aftermath, and, you know, was this a manipulated storm? And that's the question that everybody really needs to be asking. You know, I find it very interesting, the timing that's involved in this thing, how Trump pulls us out, officially anyway, on a national level, from the Paris Climate Agreement, and then all of a sudden, after having a very quiet, many, many very quiet seasons in hurricane land, all of a sudden, you know, we just get bombarded with a massive storm system. And I don't know, I haven't had a chance to check on Hurricane Irma, but that was a new storm system developing a couple of days ago, which was threatening Florida, last I knew. So I'll have to, maybe I'll check into on that as time progresses. But we got into a side discussion related to this on how these natural disasters are being used and have been used historically to control private property. And I referred to a document earlier, Sustainable Development and Natural Hazards Mitigation. They say in this document, despite the wide array of tools and techniques that are available to governments to operationalize the principles of sustainability and mitigation, one of the roadblocks to implementation is the fact that much of the land within local jurisdictions has already been developed according to practices and traditions that are far from sustainable. Ironically, the time immediately following a natural disaster provides a community with a unique window of opportunity for inserting an ethic of sustainability in guiding development and redevelopment in high-risk areas. With forethought and planning, communities that are rebuilt in the aftermath of a natural hazard can be built back so that they are more resilient to future hazards, breaking the pattern of repeated hazard destruction rebuilding. At the same time, the community is given the opportunity to incorporate other attributes of sustainability into its second chance development, such as energy efficiency, affordable housing, use of recycled building materials, and reduction of water use and environmental protection. So in other words, crisis equals opportunity, and we see this theme constantly in everything that's going on today. The Hegelian dialectic, this idea that if you create chaos, you can bring about the proper order. And certainly weather modification is something that needs to be explored more. It needs to be looked at more, because after so many decades, you know, at least a half a century of research that the government has been doing quietly on the subject, you don't think that they own the weather? I would be very, very surprised if they didn't. Anyway,
oh, yeah. Didn't Harvey sit out there in the Gulf with like a high pressure system on each side of him, just kind of guiding them in? In the countryside around here, you know, Texas is majority of it is private property. So, you know, the big thing around here is they really push all these government agencies. They're pushing, you know, wildlife, easements, wildlife mm-hmm. conservation easements.
Yeah.
Your land can stay the same, you know, forever, but they turn it over to a trust. You know, these trusts hold it and govern it and regulate it and control what goes on. So who are these trusts? Who owns these trusts? What are these things that, you know, you're giving your land away. That's how they're getting a lot of it out here, because everyone's, you know, coming out, oh, well, I want to be green. I want the land to stay the way it is. You know, I don't want it to turn into a subdivision or anything. So, you know, they'll do these wildlife easements and not really probably knowing, you know, the fine print that it basically makes it worthless for, you know, passing down to your children. There's nothing could be done to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
it's
alarming.
And besides that, it might not even preserve it, because Nature's Conservancy, which is one of the biggest land trust organizations, they'll sell the land and for a business. You know, so you're not even assured. And I mean, if you put your property into one of those trusts, that it will actually stay as.
With the encumbrance on the property, you're saying?
Yeah. Well, when they get control of it.
Right.
Once they get control of the property after you die, then they can sell it. And Nature's Conservancy is doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it doesn't surprise me that you have bankers like a former Goldman guy who was also at the same time the Federal Reserve the Treasury, Henry Paulson is who I'm thinking of. He was in both the Treasury Department and the Nature Conservancy.
Mm-hmm.
And the corporate boards that are interlocked and then just basically one corporation. I see now where, was it Dow Chemical and some other large chemical company joined together, DuPont or something like that. They're basically probably joined already. I mean, the boards of directors are probably basically almost the same. But, the corruption is just everywhere, and it's just how much can we steal, how much can we suck out of the little people. And the little people don't even really know what's going on. That's the sad thing.
No, that's the way it always is.
I appreciate y'all letting me hang on this long. I'll let you go ahead and get on with the show here.
All right. Hey, I appreciate the call there, Alan. God bless you, sir. I'll talk later, and stay dry. Yeah. Lots of people in Texas are not staying dry. Jason out in Utah sent me this document, which is, I find it interesting, although I don't know much about it, but if it's authentic, it certainly strongly suggests that this storm was a manipulated storm. So I'm just going to share a little of the document with you, and we're still researching this, and apparently there's an organization, in fact, maybe I can pull up the link here in a moment, which put this out on their Facebook page. This organization has been working for quite a while, I guess, to expose weather modification. But the document is put out, apparently, by the Trans-Pecos Weather Modification Association. And it is dated August 24th, 2017, and is called a seeding report. And it says, synoptic mesoscale conditions. Southwesterly flow aloft will work in conjunction with abundant surface moisture to help initiate, not mitigate, but initiate shower and storms. It appears that the best shot will be across western sections of the Trans-Pecos, where a weak dry line is set up. Although dynamics aloft are favorable, surface conditions will not favor organized development. Therefore, do not expect any severe weather with today's convection. And they go on to give some details about freezing level, participle water in inches, and other cloud base, and cloud depth parameters. Looks all very technical. And then they say under the heading of discussions, showers and storms were ongoing across southeastern New Mexico into the northern edges of the Trans-Pecos. Meteorologist was out of town for TDLR meeting, but upon arrival back to SJT, pilot got airborne. Regardless, convection was heavily embedded from Van Horn northeastward towards Wink. Pilot will fly along a south to north heading ahead of the convection to see what we have to work with. Pilot arrived to larger shower system in Culberson, Reeves County, and that is in Texas. A storm was nudging forward into Reeves County, which provided a small window for seeding opportunity. We took it and fired two dosages of glaciogenic flares, but Pilot was getting into some heavily embedded cloud coverage / virga. We'll move off to the northeast, just to the north, to Toya, where new development was ongoing. However, it appears the anvil from larger system to west has blocked any additional heating. Still, one dosage of seeding took place in this cluster of new shower/storm development. A pilot tried to give other showers a fair shot, but Mother Nature was not playing along today. Will RTB at 22Z and regrouped for tomorrow? Anyway, apparently, if, as I said, if this document is authentic, this looks like that they were somebody And again, that the heading is Trans-Pecos Weather Modification Association. But somebody was manipulating or trying to manipulate a storm system about the time this thing was developing. And you can say, well, maybe they were seeding clouds to starve the storm that was developing or had developed of much-needed moisture. But hurricanes are known for pulling water out of the ocean, in this case, the Gulf. So how would seeding in some other place rob it from water when it's getting its water from the Gulf? It raises some interesting questions if, in fact, this document turns out to be not a fraud, and it certainly looks genuine. And I'm not trying to give it credence or to take away credence. I'm just looking at it for what it is. And that is something that has emerged. Anyway, I just found it interesting.
I know that they're funding weather modification. I saw in an energy bill, I believe it was, that where they had money in that legislation for weather modification.
For weather modification?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And I can't quite remember, but I do remember that Idaho Power was involved in that in some way. And so, and that the thought occurred to me, well, you know, isn't that handy? You know, if they need some extra revenue, they can perhaps, you know, keep it a little colder in the winter time. You know, somehow, you know, push cold air from Canada down here. I don't know. I remember when I was a kid, they used to always show the jet stream, mm-hmm. and I don't think they do that anymore.
Well, I don't watch a whole lot of commercial television anymore, so I don't know what the meteorologists do.
But I'm sure that they are doing weather modification, and I actually did see that Texas, the state of Texas, has a weather modification agency.
Yeah, I think Oklahoma does too. If I remember, and it's been several years since I've looked at it, but I believe they do too, and I don't know how many other states do, but the question is how many of these storm systems have been manipulated, or at least there's something going on in the background that does something, because we know we're hearing constantly about the increase of intensity in storms. You know, it's interesting, there is a documentary that was put out by TruthStream Media. These folks are great. I find nothing that they really put out to be, you know, I've looked for any kind of angles for bias and ways to discredit them in my mind, I guess. And they look like really genuine people. It's Aaron and Melissa Dykes. I think they put out a lot of fantastic information.
Aaron Dykes he worked for InfoWars?
Yeah, at one time both of them did actually. Yeah. Melissa was, in fact, it may have been where they met. I don't know, but she used to be, before they were married, she was. Now I'm blanking out on her maiden name now. I guess it doesn't matter. But anyway, yeah, she was, before they were married, she worked there at InfoWars as well. But they struck out on their own for whatever reason. And they continue to put out some fantastic information. And one of those things that they put out was a documentary on the subject of weather modification. And ironically, it was put out before Hurricane Harvey came into being. And I don't know, you know, how long it took them to put this together. But it is a short 12-minute documentary. That I think, you know, in fact, I got the audio here. Let me just play some of this for you, because this is really, really excellent research that they put together.
For several months now, we've been seeing strange pulse wave patterns emanating from Antarctica that appear to be feeding into our jet stream. And there are a lot of theories about what's really going on down there, because for all intents and purposes, most of Antarctica is closed off to the general public. But after all we've read about it, the only thing that we're really sure of is that the majority of everyone has never been told the full story of what is really happening down there. But this is something we came across during our research for the Antarctica video that we put together. It's another breadcrumb we've been left with. What people don't realize today about weather modification and control is that this was something being openly discussed and widely celebrated during the Cold War, especially in the late 50s and throughout the 60s. Full control of the Earth's climate was an openly stated goal right alongside space travel when they first started talking about all these things that they were going to be able to do after World War II. Walt Disney even made one of his propaganda films about it.
In the world of tomorrow, weather control will enrich and safeguard our daily lives. On the ground, chemical cloud seeders begin to work the two storm areas. Robot planes seed the clouds from above. These artificial clouds will block the sun from evaporating more water. All available forces have been brought into play. Now we can only watch and wait.
By the 1957-58 geophysical year, which centered around internationally cooperative Antarctica-based research, at least four dozen weather research stations were being operated in Antarctica by 11 different nations. And in reports on the findings of the geophysical year, Antarctic scientists were announcing a new belief that the whole world's weather is a single closed circuit. And being the greatest manufacturer of cold air on the planet, Antarctica could be used as one huge world weather control station to change everything from the pattern of the seasons to the levels of the seas by manipulating the vast thicknesses of the ice down there through solar or nuclear power. By the 50s, widespread experimentation was already underway in Antarctica to achieve the goal of weather and climate control. Dr. Harry Wexler is still considered one of the preeminent meteorologists of the 20th century. The MIT-trained director of research at the U.S. Weather Bureau and chief U.S. scientist of the 57-58 International Geophysical Year in Antarctica had already come up with several ideas about how governments and militaries could control the planet's weather. A 1959 Hartford Courant article discussed Wexler's plan for clearing the Arctic Ocean of all ice and making travel from New York to the Orient much faster by detonating 10 hydrogen bombs under the water and blowing enough steam into the polar sky to blanket the ocean with an ice fog that would drastically cut the amount of heat escaping the ocean and thus prevent new ice from being able to form there. But he was worried the plan would actually drown many famous ports across the world and throw the whole planet into a new ice age, so they weren't sure if they wanted to do it or not. Wexler also discussed firing off hydrogen bombs to rip hurricanes apart and launching a fine powder into equatorial orbit like the rings of Saturn around Earth to shade it from the sun. Sound familiar? It should. They've only been discussing doing it for years.
Yeah, they call it geoengineering now.
You know, I did.
What's that?
I said I just can't fathom why anybody would want to do that, because obviously if it is a closed system, if you disturb the system, you could destroy everything.
Well, there, you know, she goes on to talk about how Wexler, who was a proponent of this at the time, later on began to fight it. He began to recant and reverse course and spent much of the rest of his life until his untimely death by a heart attack, which was questionable. You know, trying to expose it and trying to get them to stop because he was afraid that it was creating permanent damage to the environment.
Of course it would. That's what I meant. I mean, you know, the Earth has, you know, what it may not seem like perfect weather to us, but for the Earth, it is a perfect system. And if you mess with that system, you could destroy everything.
Yeah, and this is the argument that the environmentalists, you know, so-called environmentalists, the people controllers, try to use against us is that, oh, the Earth's got a fragile ecosystem. And yet they're the first ones to be proposing something like this to try to mitigate global warming, which isn't even a problem.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking about, you know, those morons that talk about the fragile ecosystem. I'm talking about the big thing, the weather of the planet. Mm-hmm. You're talking about doing something down in Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
Like blowing up hydrogen bombs, you know, to prevent cooling of the water. I mean, it's just, that is just so insane. If you would destroy something like the weather patterns of the world, I mean, that's big stuff. That's big, big stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they could destroy the world.
Yeah. And I don't know if, honestly, I don't know if it, I mean, I think we have the capability for, you know, in the case like for nuclear stuff, to destroy the world for many, many years to come and make, I mean, ultimately, with that kind of power, you can make the planet uninhabitable for a very long time. And weather patterns, I believe, and maybe I'm naive here, maybe Wexler knew something, I'm sure he knows plenty, that knew plenty that I don't know, because he was an expert in this area. But it sounded like he was worried that literally weather patterns would be permanently altered. Permanently altered. In other words, there's no going back. Naively,
right. Exactly.
I've always believed that you can, if you leave it alone long enough, eventually it will naturally return to its ordinary state. I mean, just about everything in nature
does it. That
doesn't do us
any good if we're all dead, though.
Well, that's that is a kind of a downside, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, there is that.
10 Gulfstream jets outfitted with special engines that allow them to fly safely around the stratosphere at an altitude of 70,000 feet take off from a runway near the equator, and their cargo includes thousands of pounds of a chemical compound.
By 1962, however, Dr. Wexler was singing a different tune on weather modification. His new calculations worried him that rocket fuels of the type the world's militaries had been firing off into the atmosphere in all manner of experiments, weather and otherwise, since the end of World War II, was possibly permanently affecting the climate and irreparably changing the world's weather for the worse. Throughout 1962, he delivered a speech titled On the Possibilities of Climate Control to at least three different groups across the country.
Now listen to what she says about his speech.
On how the residues of rocket fuels, including chlorine and bromine compounds, were contaminating the upper atmosphere, not just by destroying the ozone layer, but by punching holes in the ionosphere. James Fleming of Colby College points out that Wexler was concerned not just about industrial pollution of the lower atmosphere, but that planetary-scale manipulation of the Earth's shortwave and longwave radiation budget would result in, quote, rather large-scale effects on general circulation patterns in short or longer periods, even approaching that of climate change, end quote. In other words, Wexler was saying that these rocket fuel compound residues were causing what could eventually be permanent climate change. And by the way, as Fleming points out, our modern history of ozone depletion only really dates back to the 70s. That's when they started talking about that as being an issue and a problem that we were facing.
Why don't you hear about this in the media? When you got dirtbags on TV pushing the climate change all the time, and you got rich fat cats like Bill Gates openly promoting the concept of geoengineering, nobody ever talks about Wexler and his concerns about permanent climate damage being caused by what they were doing. And I ask the question, is anybody think that does anybody think that any of this stuff has stopped? I mean, are we naive enough to believe that they've quit doing this, that this is all stuff of the past?
You know, that's brings up a point that I've thought about quite a lot, is having a multi-billionaire class of people that are involved in social change. I mean, you know, Soros or Bloomberg or, you know, those billionaires, they could afford to send up a plane every single day and spray whatever the hell they want to spray on us. Well, would anybody stop them? I really seriously doubt it.
You know, how do we know that the jet fuel in the aircraft today aren't doing this, and it's just ordinary commercial jets that, you know, I mean, we hear a lot about contrails and chemtrails. I remember interviewing a gentleman years ago. He's dead now, unfortunately, but he talked a lot about weather modification, and he was an expert in this area, and he made the statement. He said that the jet fuel has changed, which complicates things. He says because that the jet fuel actually, I'm trying to remember exactly how he put it, but something to the effect of it lingers longer in the air. And that complicates knowing whether or not it is a chemtrail versus whether it's jet fuel. What if they're putting this stuff in jet fuel? What if it is a part of it, the geoengineering process, that provides plausible deniability? And I realize there are some trails that linger and some that don't. But my point is this would be perfect. I mean, if I was evil and I wanted to do this, that's exactly the way I would do it. I put it in the jet fuel.
Yeah.
That way you
got
plausible deniability, and you can laugh at all the conspiracy nuts when they point to it and say, "Ha!" Anyway, we're at the bottom of the hour. Stay tuned, folks. This is Govern America. Vicki Davis, Darren Weeks, and we'll be back in a moment.
You know, as they look forward after the response and recovery of the safety of the individuals and the communities, but also they need to look forward a few weeks down the road now, mm-hmm. of how are we going to build back? Are we going to build back better and safer? Or are we going to let it go as it has? And the thing of it is, if you look at climate change and you look at the weather systems that we're getting today, just normal rainstorms are 6 or 7 inches, and we have to start doing more in prevention and mitigation before these events happen, and we got to break the damage repair cycle. This is extremely, you know, people worked all their lives for what they had, and now it's lost and gone, and so this is going to be a really, really tough recovery.
There's former FEMA chief James Lee Witt on CNN pushing the agenda. Welcome back to Govern America, ladies and gentlemen. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. You know, the Drudge Report had on earlier this week, Harvey dumps 9 trillion tons of water. That was one headline. Another one was, rainfall could reach 50 inches. Widespread devastation. Why wasn't Houston evacuated? That was another thing where we had the mayor of Houston telling people to stay put, while the governor was saying, no, get out, you should really consider leaving. And the mayor asserted and insisted, no, you know, local officials know best. So this created the big controversy. Why wasn't Houston evacuated? Dallas prepares convention center, mega shelter, Cajun Navy mass mobilization, fish were inside the home, damage may match Katrina, floodwaters nearly reach highway signs, a dog carrying, okay, we don't, you know, dog carrying a bag of food was fun to look at, but that's not as important. Anyway, the point is that there's a lot going on with this storm that's questionable. And without people talking about the weather aspect of it, manipulation and control, I believe this storm was a manipulated storm. I mean, it's very interesting to see the pattern that it took.
Well, I was pretty interested in how it was being reported, because they reported that it was a class 3, and I don't know if it's just my memory or what, but I don't recall class 3 hurricanes causing such damage before Katrina. I mean, they kind of didn't even, now it could be my memory is faulty, because I've never lived in hurricane country. I did stay in Florida, and when a tropical storm blew in, I was all for evacuating, because it was so scary.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to stay. But I understand people who do want to stay, because they're worried about their property.
Sure.
They're worried about the looting. And
worries, and
they want to be able to be there to protect their, you know, what they own. But and many of these people, let's face it, I mean, there's some shut-ins. There are people that are not very easily to, you know, mobile. They're not. It's not easy for them to move, and they have no place to go. A lot of people don't have resources and money to stay in hotels and things like that. So they wait them out.
Yeah, those are the people that the government should worry about, but don't.
Yeah. So, anyway, we started sharing a little bit from the documentary, on weather modification from TruthStream Media. I'm going to play a little bit more of this, and then I'll try to move on to other things.
It's also a good time to point out that by 1962, when Wexler was saying this, the U.S. military, USSR, and others had been not only detonating rockets in the atmosphere for various science and military experiments, including hundreds of sounding rockets from Antarctica, but they were also reportedly blowing up nuclear warheads in the upper atmosphere, including top-secret high-altitude nuclear testing operations Hardtack and Argus in 1958, and Operation Fishbowl, which had just begun in 1962 when Wexler began making these claims. Wexler noted that the effects could be temporary, but he also said these compounds could be left behind as a catalyst that could cause permanent climate and weather changes. He warned of, quote, a growing anxiety that, quote, man, in applying his growing energies and facilities against the power of the winds and storms, may do so with more enthusiasm than knowledge, and so cause more harm than good. There had also been some suggestion that the world's militaries could use this kind of knowledge to wage geophysical warfare by purposefully attacking the ozone layer over an enemy country. Wexler spent 1962 warning against man's attempt to control the climate and the weather, and that rocket fuels could be doing irreversible damage to the planet's climate. This was a man who was sitting on every relevant scientific advisory board on weather and weather research that the U.S. had at the time. He was working alongside the likes of John von Neumann, and he'd been writing papers on weather control for JFK. So he knew what he was talking about, or at least he should have. And now he was publicly warning against one of the U.S. military's biggest stated goals and biggest justifications for the scientific takeover of Antarctica, where the majority of rocket launches and weather experimentation was taking place at that time. Wexler obviously told the DOD all about his concerns, because he was quoted in the Daily Press in February 1962 as saying, "The most heartening thing is that the Department of Defense has ordered an investigation of the possible side effects. These fuels are so new that no one knows much about their effect." So Sadly, though, that speech on the possibilities of climate control that he gave in 1962, warning about the potentially permanent negative effects of detonating all these rockets and bombs off in the Earth's atmosphere, and what that was doing to the world's weather and climate, would be the last speech that Harry Wexler would ever give. In August 1962, Dr. Harry Wexler suffered a heart attack at the age of 51 while on vacation in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and died at a Boston hospital a week later. That speech would have normally been published, but due to his untimely death, it never was. A 1962 publication titled Antarctic Research, which includes papers presented to the 10th Pacific Science Congress and bears Wexler's name as editor, was published posthumously in 1962 and features a memorial about him, but makes no mention of his startling findings earlier that year. Even more curious, the first international symposium on rocket and satellite meteorology was held in April of 1962 when he was still alive and was organized in part by him. Surely he had mentioned his findings there at that symposium, except nothing about his speech or his comments on this matter is mentioned in the final publication of the symposium, which also bears a memorial to Wexler. Eerily, a Rand Corporation man paraphrases Wexler's remarks on opening the symposium regarding man's endeavor to push higher into the atmosphere with his instruments. It's unbelievable that Wexler would not have mentioned the fact that he discovered those very instruments could be permanently screwing up the Earth's climate at that symposium. Weather modification experiments continued unabated, as did rocket and bomb tests. The year after Wexler died and the day after JFK was assassinated, it quietly came out after multiple government denials that a nuclear weapon had been fired in supposedly peaceful Antarctica for reasons the public was never told. The National Academy of Sciences that same year appointed a panel on weather and climate modification to, quote, undertake a deliberate and thoughtful review of the present status and activities in this field and its potential and limitations for the future. The following year, 1964, the director of National Science Foundation announced the appointment of a special commission on weather modification, and by 1966, NASA Administrator Homer Newell completed a report to the Interdepartmental Committee for Atmospheric Sciences titled A Recommended National Program in Weather Modification, which advocated direct modification of the weather to include lightning suppression efforts, which if you think about it, just seems like a really bad idea that would disrupt the electrical balance of the atmosphere, and that's just for starters. Even Newell admitted in his own report that their weather modification experiments had shown, quote, changes in species, which led to, quote, considerable uncertainties relative to specific results of weather modification. In other words, all of the stuff that the Club of Rome began blaming on the rest of us in the 1970s, everything from ozone depletion to climate change to negatively impacting the flora and the fauna, can also be traced back to widespread government weather modification experimentation and military rocket and nuclear bomb testing dating back to the 50s and 60s and warned about by Dr. Harry Wexler just before his untimely death in 1962. Today, we see things like this.
Buildings have collapsed. There are reports from New Orleans of people trapped in buildings that have come down around them.
Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, has been hit by a major earthquake.
Earthquake in Japan, a powerful quake.
The tsunami has engulfed several cities.
This is the moment Japan's nuclear disaster began.
Drop regular programming to bring you this weather alert.
There is a tornado on the ground in the southern portions of Joplin, just to the south of our station here.
We're told all the time that human beings are the cause for all the environmental woes, and thus we have no other choice than to turn over our trust to the government for global geoengineering experiments to commence. And although we will likely never be told how far weather modification and control experimentation went, or where those experiments are at today, when you see something like this coming up from Antarctica, just realize that they've only been talking about using that still mostly off-limits continent for planetary weather control since the 1950s, and warnings against the possible irreparable damage of widespread weather modification and geoengineering from someone who was there during all of that early experimentation and who went down in history as one of the greatest meteorologists the U.S. has ever had, were ignored.
What do you think of that?
I'm just sick. It makes
that's,
me sick.
That's the whole... We ended up playing the whole documentary, which, you know, I'm glad we did, because honestly, excellent work by TruthStream Media and Melissa Dykes, who used to be Melissa Melton. I remembered now her maiden name. When she worked for InfoWars, she was Melissa Melton. But now she's her and Aaron Dykes married, and now they're doing great work on their own. And I appreciate that, because more people need to be aware that this is going on. If you talk about it, you're considered a crackpot. But this is a very real threat to mankind. We're being blamed for climate change. We're being blamed for global warming. And yet they're screwing with the weather. Nothing is natural anymore. Everything that's natural or has been natural in the past is being taken away from us, from our food to our weather.
Yeah. Nothing is sacred anymore. It's just our entire planet has kind of become a playground for people that I think are psychopaths. Because if you have that, anything that you change permanently, you know, if you could change the weather permanently, if you change the genetics of man permanently through experience, if you, I don't know. I think it's a sin. It's the ultimate sin, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Here we see from Southwest Farm Press, Hurricane Harvey wreaks havoc on Texas agriculture. At least 100 cotton storage modules blown away and flooding expected to disrupt wheat shipments. So how much of our food prices are going to go up as a result, not to mention clothing and other things made of cotton? You know, we already know that fuel prices are going to be on the rise. I went yesterday to fill up all of my gas cans at the gas station. You know, and I recommend other people doing that as well, because even though the so-called experts are saying that these refineries are only going to be shut down for a couple of weeks, how do we really know? You know,
that's true.
It seems
right.
Like a very perfect storm, no pun intended, to get fuel prices, which have been hovering around $2-something a gallon, at least here in Michigan, back up to $4 or $5 a gallon, or maybe even $6 a gallon, if the chokehold stays put.
I was reading an article yesterday or the day before about a chemical plant in Houston,
mm-hmm.
and because of the water, they didn't have the electricity on, and because the electricity wasn't on, there was a possibility that they could have a chemical explosion, because whatever their system was for managing the chemicals in that plant, they weren't working. And so, you know, there was a possibility that that chemical plant might blow up.
Yeah, and I think there was already some kind of, I thought I had a piece in here on that, but I'm not finding it at the moment. But yeah, people could easily search for it. In fact, I thought there might have already been explosions there.
And that's one of the fallacies of that central planning that this guy, you know, Harvard University, his name is Michael Porter, mm-hmm. and he's the one that recommended the changes to our financial system. Changes for businesses to give us, quote, the competitive advantage of nations. He's the one that brought forward all of that Ricardo crapola, mm-hmm. you know, of free trade and all of that.
Yeah.
He's the one that, you know, brought
he's
that
the, he's
back
the guy that talks
from
with
the,
his...
from the eight from the 18th century.
He's the guy that talks with his hands, right? Isn't that the same guy?
Yeah.
I remember him.
I've noticed, you know, quite a few economists do that. when you hear an economist, when you watch him give a presentation, mm-hmm. don't watch their hands because that's
it'll drive you nuts.
Trick.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Michael Porter is a guy that's particularly bad, too, because, I mean, his hands are just all over the place. It's like he's got a swarm of bees after him.
Sure, and what he does, he gets them moving, and you watch his hands, and you really aren't listening to what he's saying.
It's a subliminal programming.
It is. And you know what? I absolutely believe that the real purpose of economists are nothing more than credentialed con men.
I like that. Mm-hmm. Credentialed con men. Love it. All right, I'll tell you what. Let's go to the phones. We have a call from Tennessee on the line. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello. Hey, Vicki. What came to mind when you said credentialed con men? Conconomist.
I thought
it was funny.
Perfect. Thanks for the show title.
Anyway, you know, Darren, you and I spoke yesterday, and I told you about a YouTube channel that had what I believe is pretty damning evidence about NASA contributing to, if not controlling, Hurricane Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
And that was started out with a 1989, I believe, video with that Jeremy guy from Top Gear in Mississippi watching NASA create a cloud that 2 minutes later created rain. And there's a guy on YouTube, Richie from Boston. He seems pretty straight up to me, although you got to be careful when you're listening to his videos if you're opposed to a little bit of foul language because he tends to get angry.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he has what he says, the satellite view during the hurricane, I believe, like from the 30th of August or the 29th of August, where you can see this area in Mississippi that basically ignited the storm by creating another cloud after a 500-second burst from a rocket engine that produced a cloud of hydrogen and oxygen, you know, big cloud. So if you're feeling a warm weather front with a cold cloud, you're going to increase the convection and increase the intensity of the storm. So they may not be, and don't get me wrong, I believe they're attempting to control the weather, and that's evident in what Cohen said back in Atlanta years ago, where countries were involved in a certain form of eco-terrorism. Let's not forget, they've been doing this. They did it on the Ho Chi Minh Trail with Operation Popeye, and we're seeing them do it now, and they're doing it for their own benefit, blaming global warming, which is non-existent, and any kind of warming that may be created is being created by them.
Yeah. And by the way, that Cohen quote, I am told, I was on the Republic of Texas broadcast probably 3 or 4 weeks ago as a guest, and I used that quote, and the caller said, well, the problem is that they claim now that he was reading from a book when he said that. And I hadn't heard that was supposedly tainted now, because, yes, he technically said it, and it is in the transcript. I know it was in the transcript, because I read the transcript. But he actually...
As did I.
He actually... They claim now he was reading from a fictional book. But why would he be reading from a fictional book, and why would he be reading that particular thing from a fictional book? So, I don't know, you know, and the problem is they've taken down the transcript now. So you can't go back to try to see if he really looked like he was reading from a book.
Well, I'll have to look in my phone, because I have a tendency to download PDF files.
Mm-hmm.
So I may have it in my phone. But in any case, you know, I can remember as a kid, Darren, I'll be 60 this month. I can remember as a kid Saturday morning cartoons where, yes, it was fantasy or predictive programming or advanced notification where some villain would say, I'm going to control the weather. They want to do it. Kissinger himself said, if you want to control people, you control the food and the weather. You know, mm-hmm. So I mean, there's a great deal of military advantage to being able to wreak a storm or hurricane or flood or volcano on another country. And I know that they're doing it. I mean, I haven't got any proof, but something, you know, you know certain things, you know, and you can't prove. You can call it whatever you want, intuition or being able to read between the lines or connect the dots, but it is occurring. They've admitted to a certain amount of it in Vietnam, and I'll guarantee you that if they had the technology 50 years ago, that it's a lot farther along now where they can basically whip it up in a heartbeat.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's what I had. A conconomist. You know, money's phony. Why not the economist?
I love it. Thanks.
Anyway.
All right. Blessings.
All right. Take care, bud.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Thank Vicky.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Here he is, John in Tennessee. Yeah, conconomist. Great term.
All of them, you know, I like to watch C-SPAN a lot, and just about every economist that I've ever
seen. You like watching C-SPAN?
I do.
Torture. That's like enjoying torture.
Well, that's what everybody says, but I really enjoy it.
Well, having it on in the background is, I would enjoy getting the information and understanding what's going on. Man, listening to some of these people talk.
When I go visit my son, he removes those channels from his TV.
Yeah, I don't think it's good to bury our head in the sand, that's for sure. But and which is why I appreciate our audience. You know, I appreciate people out there listening because you care. The only reason you'd listen to a program like this is because you care and you want to know. And people that want to know are people that I respect and I hold up as heroes. Because you can't do anything to solve a problem unless you know what the problem really is. Unless you know what the source of it is.
That's absolutely true.
So get your head out of the sand, people. And I'm not talking about really preaching to the choir here. But people need to get their head out of the sand and pay attention. At the very least, know what's going on so that we can be focused on dealing with the problem and bringing about solutions. At the top of the hour already, it's amazing how fast the time goes. Stay with us. Hour number 3 of Govern America is straight ahead.
Crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro-FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5, this is the third and final hour of Govern America. Darren Weeks and Vicki Davis here with you, as we are every Saturday. Hope you'll tell some folks about the broadcast. And we're continuing on here on this 2nd of September 2017. Did a look up here on Hurricane Irma, and apparently it is still churning away. It is currently now... has 110 mile per hour wind speeds with gusts up to 132 miles per hour, and it is moving at a pace of 15 miles per hour, so still going very slow, but yet the wind speeds are 110 and gusts up to 132, and it's threatening the path. The cone is certainly threatening the east coast of the United States now, as it's projected to be a Category 3 by the 7th of September, later on this week. Actually, I think it's projected to be a Category 3 as early as tomorrow. Yeah, that's what they're saying. And it's headed right toward Florida. at this point in time, according to certain the computer models for this thing. So it's going to be very interesting, to say the least. And then there's also one apparently on the West Coast called Lydia, which is currently a tropical storm. It's got 40
on the west coast of where?
It's out near let's see, I guess it's actually off of the coast of California. Actually, it's Baja California. But it's headed north, and I don't...
Well, that's kind of
actually,
rare,
I don't think it's actually a threat to the United States based upon the projections of this. But it is a threat to Baja California.
Yeah, that's
although
kind of
they
rare.
Do,
they don't get... I don't think they get hurricanes there that often, that frequently.
I've seen them before, but and I don't know if this thing is going to go toward Hawaii or not. It doesn't look like they have it projected to be a threat to the lower 48, or, you know, the 48 states, the contiguous. You know what I'm saying? But
yeah, I always thought the weather in on the West Coast, or, you know, the western United States is too cold. Pacific Ocean is, the water there is cold,
mm-hmm.
whereas the Atlantic is warm.
Well, you know, it's all that global warming, Vicky. The global warming is to blame.
But I think it was always warm.
Speaking of global warming and frauds, the Daily Wire came out with a report on the subject of this new study that was done by...
Uh-oh, a new study.
Oh, yeah, new study. But this study you will never hear about probably any place but Govern America and other alternative media sources, because it doesn't toe the line. Jennifer Mohassey, a scientist with a rather long list of impressive credentials, which includes the founding of the Climate Modeling Laboratory, opens her startling climate report with a dose of reality. She says, our new technical paper will likely be ignored. And she wrote that in the Spectator Australia. She goes on to explain why. She says, because after applying the latest big data technique to six 2,000-year-long proxy temperature series, we cannot confirm that recent warming is anything but natural. What might have occurred anyway, even if there is no industrial revolution. There was no industrial revolution. They say, oh my, talk about an inconvenient truth, if you'll pardon the expression. In other words, Mohassey understands what she is up against when it comes to this issue, the issue of climate change, which has become an article of faith, not just among the left and its media, but within a scientific community eager to destroy any heretic who dares question the dogma of Gaia. Now, I would take issue with this idea of the quote-unquote scientific community. We don't really know how many in the quote-unquote scientific community, you know, and I hate that because it's not a community. It is a group of people who are scientists.
Who get grants to
but that's
say
the problem.
That there's climate change.
The people that don't go along don't get grant money, and then the others are bullied. So how do we know what the scientific community, if there were such a thing, how do we know what they really think? Because, yeah, like everything else, there are bullies out there suppressing information.
That is the one thing that I will give credit to Donald Trump for. When he said we're not signing on to the Paris Climate Agreement, he basically set the real scientists free to talk about the truth.
But
if
are they?
But
are they talking about the truth?
Some of them are beginning to speak out, and apparently this lady is one of them.
Because when you have the possibility that your staff will be stripped from you, that you will, you know, families depend upon the money that you're receiving from the federal government, that is a real problem. And
It takes a pretty brave soul to go up against conventional wisdom, whether it's true wisdom or not, you know, even if it's a big lie. It takes a lot of intestinal fortitude to swim upstream. And yeah. And honestly, most people don't have that kind of intestinal fortitude. They just keep quiet and go along to get along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, President Trump is donating $1 million to Hurricane Harvey efforts, and you know, my hat is off to him for that too. Mm-hmm. I don't give him credit for much because there's a lot to dislike with his administration, especially now. And as we go further along, it looks like we were totally right about the NAFTA renegotiation.
Yeah, well, and that's the farce, the infrastructure, that article about the infrastructure and selling off infrastructure, that kind of makes a mockery of his supposedly renegotiating NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
Because the critical infrastructure thing, it has to do with ports and port security and international transportation and fusion centers.
Yep.
And so,
which is the total police state at work.
Absolute total police state.
Speaking of police state.
And having a foreign direct investment, which is coming from the communist Chinese, which began probably began in the United States. But when I first found it, it began in Mexico, you know, with Vicente Fox making deals with the communist Chinese to build ports in southern Mexico, and then inland ports coming up to Kansas City, and then spreading out throughout the United States in what they call high priority corridors.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and those fusion centers that connect all of the critical infrastructure, the utilities, the hospitals, the 911 system, all of that is being financed by the communist Chinese. Through foreign direct investment, yes, through the EB-5 regional centers.
Yeah, and Trump is all in on that. His people are actively recruiting the Chinese for EB-5, through EB-5.
One of the things that I'm doing, after I read that article and I about flipped my cork, I decided to put together on one page all of my links to all of my research on the transportation system and the ports. And, you know, I'm not rewriting it. I'm just putting all the links out there so that people can go and just read it as is if they want to. You know, if I don't know how many people get into reading transportation legislation. God, I'm weird. I can't help it.
Well, people think all of us are weird, I think. But yeah. We have U.S. military is sending warships and aircraft to Texas. And this is the thing. You know, posse comitatus was a prohibition of militarization of local police departments. And yet we're having this. We're seeing this go on everywhere. Obama had the 1033 program, and Sessions has come out and announced that they were going to, the 1033 program is something that Obama did away with, and it's one of the few things that I actually agreed with Obama, although I didn't agree with the reason why he did it. I mean, Obama had a war going against local police, and I do think local police are necessary, despite what other people will debate me on. I think we need them, but we need them to not be militarized. We need them to be accountable when they do wrong. But at the same time, we don't want them to have, you know, tanks rolling through the streets like they did in Boston during the marathon, where they shut down the whole city. Essentially, undeclared martial law. People were told to shelter in place. They would be arrested if they moved outside of their house. All because of a teenager. And the whole event was highly questionable. And I think that was a rehearsal. I think we've seen a number of these rehearsals.
Well, you know what the thing is that they've built this huge infrastructure of a modern East German Stasi information network for sharing at all levels of the Justice Department. It's not just the police department. It includes the prosecutors. The health and welfare office. I mean, you know, it includes all of that. They've built this gigantic information collection and dissemination system, and they really don't have a lot to show for it. And so, you know, I found a few reports showing that they're really not getting their money's worth. They're spending billions of dollars. They've spent about $1 trillion in total since 9/11. And they're not getting much out of it. And so once the government builds a system like this, you've got a lot of people's livelihoods that are dependent on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like refugee resettlement. They allowed a business to be built.
That's the problem.
The prison industry, they allowed a business to be built on the prison industry. Well, you know, when you build industries like that to address social problems, they're obviously social problems are going to be created just to, so
you never
that they
get rid
can
of
keep
it.
Getting their budget money.
Yeah, you never get rid of it. And it's just the reason why they're trying to build an industry around climate change. Same thing. Because if they can get it in place and people's livelihoods are dependent upon it, you've got businesses and industries built up around it, you're going to have all those people who have a stake in it, and they are the true stakeholders. They're the ones that are going to be screaming the loudest, and the more of them you get involved in it, the greater, the more difficult it is to undo the fraud. I mean, we really have a fraud-based economy, and
corruption-based.
You can't
economy.
Write the ship.
That's the irony, is that we're supposed to be a free country, but all of the country's economy has been turned over to where it's government-supported tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
All this surveillance and information collection and reporting and spying and parallel construction in the Department of Justice, and it's got to be the ultimate irony, the big joke on the American people.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's not a very funny joke.
No, and I can't think of a worse person. You know, the more I look at the fusion centers and the information sharing, it's all centered in the Department of Home Scam Security and the Justice Department. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of a worse person, actually, than Jeff Sessions to head up the Department of Justice.
Well, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because I have him here talking about the reinstatement of the 1033 program. He spoke at the Fraternal Order of Police, and this is one of the things he said.
President Trump is serious about this mission. He is doing all he can to restore law and order and support our police across America. And that's why I'm here today. one reason to announce that President Trump this day is issuing an executive order that will make it easier to protect yourselves and your communities. And it's a top priority of Chuck and your leaders. He is rescinding restrictions from the prior administration that limited your agency's ability to get equipment through federal programs, including life-saving gear. Life-saving gear to make your lives safer, like Kevlar vests and helmets, first responder and rescue equipment like they're using in Texas right now. Some of these programs, like our popular Department of Defense 1033 program that Congress passed into law more than 25 years ago, have provided and recycled more than $5.4 billion in used gear and equipment that taxpayers had already purchased and made it available to your agencies to repurpose it in the fight against terrorism, crime, and for disaster relief. Equipment like helicopters, armed vehicles are also vitally important to emergency and disaster response efforts. One sheriff told me earlier this year about how, due to prior administration restrictions, the federal government made his department return an armored vehicle that can change the dynamics in an active shooter situation. These are the types of helmets and gear that stopped a bullet and saved the life of an officer during the Orlando nightclub shooting. This is the type of equipment officers needed when they pursued and ultimately killed a terrorist in San Bernardino. Studies have shown that this equipment reduces crime rates, reduces the number of assaults against police officers.
I wonder whose studies. Who funded those studies?
It actually reduces the number of complaints against police officers. These restrictions that had been opposed went too far. We will not put superficial concerns above public safety. We will do our best to get you what you need.
There you go.
So Did you happen to see that article or that video about the nurse that was arrested by the police officer because she wouldn't draw blood from an unconscious man?
Yeah, you're talking about this one right here. I got the audio of the incident. She was explaining to the police officer the policy of the hospital, doing her job because they wanted to do a blood draw, as you said, from the patient, who was the victim, by the way. He wasn't even a criminal, wasn't even a suspect, but they wanted to do a blood draw against him, and she said, this is our policy. Our policy is, which the police department actually had agreed to, and here's how that went.
So, I have this, it says obtaining blood samples for police enforcement from patients suspected to be under the influence.
You have to bear with us a little bit because it is a little bit difficult to hear because there's a noisy background and a lot of people, it's recorded, the thing was recorded, I believe, by the officer's, body camera. So it's a little bit noisy.
You guys agreed to with this hospital.
You guys agreed to with this hospital.
The three things that allow us to do that are if you have an electronic warrant.
An electronic warrant.
Consent or patient on.
Patient's consent,
or
the patient's under arrest. Those are the three points that allow that would under circumstances under which the hospital would allow the blood draw, and the police department had agreed to that.
Either of those things, the patient can't consent. He told me repeatedly that he doesn't have a warrant, and the patient is not under arrest. So I'm just trying to do what I'm supposed to do.
Just trying to do what I'm supposed to do, that's all.
So,
okay, so I take it without those in place, I'm not going to get blood. Is that, am I fair to surmise that?
He just said, she's the one that told me no.
I'm
now, please.
No, we're done.
No, no,
we're done. You're under arrest.
Okay,
we're done.
Sir, I had a
Okay, so anyway, yeah, he says, so if I don't have those three things, then I can't get the blood draw. And she says, yes, that's the thing. And so he grabs her, says, we're done here, and puts the cuffs on her and sticks her in the squad car with her screaming, all because she's doing her job. Arguably, the patient, had she allowed the blood draw, could have sued her for civil rights violations for allowing this to happen.
Yeah, and the hospital.
And yeah, she could, going against hospital policy, she could have been fired.
Mm-hmm.
And for this, she's arrested. And these are the people that Jeff Sessions says, hey, we want to give you military equipment. We want to help you get what you need. What? So that you can victimize the population? So you can treat people? You bully them around? So, hey, you cops out there, if any of you happen to be listening, let me just tell you something right now. I'm all in favor of police keeping the peace, you know, peace officers. But you want to know why you're getting a bad rap? That's the kind of crap is the reason why you're getting a bad rap. And you know what? It's only going to get worse unless you people start keeping your own people in line. You want people to abide by the law? Why don't you start abiding by the law?
Do you know what makes me wonder is the police have access to all that data on everybody. And with actions like that police officer did, makes me question does the police department have the integrity to not misuse that data?
Of course not.
I don't think they do. I don't think anybody does.
No, I think they routinely misuse data, just like they routinely plant evidence, which is another thing that Sessions was talking about, is asset forfeiture. How the administration wants to bring back asset forfeiture.
In July, we reinstituted something Chuck and his team cared a lot about. I think a lot of you cared about. We reinstituted our equitable sharing program.
Equitable sharing program is what they call it.
Yeah.
Isn't that a great name?
Equitable sharing of stolen...
Yeah, equitable sharing program is a great name for theft.
Ensuring...
Woohoo! Yeah!
Ensuring that criminals will not be permitted to profit from their crimes, as President Trump knows well.
No, but the police will.
Civil asset forfeiture is a key tool that helps law enforcement defund organized crime.
Plant evidence.
Take back ill-gotten gains and prevent new crimes from being committed, and it weakens the criminal gangs and cartels.
Sure.
Civil asset forfeiture takes the material support of the criminals and makes it the material support of law enforcement. It, in departments across this country, funds that were once used to take lives are now being used to save lives.
Sure.
It is a top priority of the Department of Justice. You can be sure of that.
Oh, I'm sure of that.
You know what? There is absolutely no reason for that program to be...
No, no reason
abused.
At all.
...used. I mean, yeah, okay, confiscate the stuff and make the people prove that it, you know, that they had it legally. But that isn't the way that program works. They make it absolutely impossible to get their, for people to get their stuff back.
Yeah. No, what it is it provides the incentive, as I said, for police departments all across the country to plant evidence on innocent people so that they can steal their stuff.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. And I don't care what the little slimy little scumbag Jeff Sessions says.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to get so worked up. This is so irritating to me. You know, because at the time, you know, and here you got this piece of manure, George Soros, going around funding communists everywhere he goes, communist movements and everything. And this guy totally skates. Why is this guy not under investigation, Jeff Sessions? Why hasn't all of his funds been seized by the Justice Department? Why isn't this guy in cuffs? This guy should be under the jail.
Yeah, well, isn't that interesting? Yeah, I mean, they would get a lot if they did asset forfeiture with that guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Why don't they seize his assets? But no. It's like the massive, giant, monster elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about. Because that would deal with... It would make you force you to deal with the fraud that's in place. That there really is no difference between any of these characters. There is no difference between any of these administrations. They're all the same. They're all the same. I gave Trump the benefit of a doubt. Well, that benefit is gone, folks. The mask is off. This beast is being exposed for what it really is. Tell you what, we're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back in a moment. This is Governed America. Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Governed America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. The website is governedamerica.com. Governedamerica.com is the website for the radio program. And Vicki's websites are thetechnocratictyranny.com, channelingreality.com, and tvoinews.net. Talking about Jeff Sessions and the situation, the fraud that's in place with regard to whether or not we have a legitimate administration in Washington, D.C. And it's very apparent that we do not. You know, as Soros, the criminal scumbag, is allowed to go on using his billions to fund all kinds of communist uprisings in this country and seditious activities, we have the Hammonds still rotting away in prison because they were ranchers and did what ranchers do, trying to keep their crops from being burned by a fire, so setting a backfire to try to stop the fire, and for that they go to prison. No presidential pardon for them. No, you know, no leniency against the people that were standing off at Malheur. Now we have, from your newspaper in your neck of the woods, the Idaho Statesman, Vicki, a third of Idaho lawmakers ask Attorney General Sessions to back off the Bundy case. They say two failed trials is enough, some Republican legislators say. 34 Idaho lawmakers, one-third of the full combined House and Senate, sent a letter Tuesday to U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions asking him to get Nevada federal prosecutors to relax their pursuit of four Idahoans charged or convicted in connection with the 2014 Bunkerville standoff in Nevada. Quote, we believe that the decision by the U.S. current U.S. attorney to Nevada to prosecute these men a third time represents disrespect for the rule of law and the jury system, unquote, says the letter signed by 26 House members and 8 Senate members, along with 5 retired lawmakers. The four men, Ammon Bundy of Emmett, Eric Parker of Haley, Scott Drexler of Challis, and Todd Engel of Boundary County, were among nearly 20 defendants arrested in early 2016 as part of a nationwide roundup regarding the armed standoff against federal law enforcement officers, goons, listeners, that took place in April 2014. The federal officials tried rounding up the cattle that belonged to rancher Clive and Bundy, who had refused for years to pay grazing fees. And why did he refuse? Because he was being persecuted by the Bureau of Land Management, ladies and gentlemen. Federal goons.
Yeah, they were raising his grazing fees to put him out of business. It was not...
And all of his neighbors were already out of business.
Yeah.
So let's just keep paying the bullies extortion money. What, to leave us alone? They weren't leaving him alone anyway.
No, they weren't leaving him alone anyway. I mean, they were using the regulatory system to put him out of business.
Yeah.
And, I wrote an article about that called Triple Jeopardy. It just shows you how far degraded our justice system, so-called justice system, has become. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution says, nor shall any person be subject of life or limb.
Yeah, double jeopardy.
Well, yeah, he's already, those two guys have already been in jeopardy twice.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to put him in jeopardy again. And, you know, there are so many laws on the books that they can keep, you know, pulling out different laws forever.
Yeah.
But that is an abuse of the prosecutorial process.
Yeah. High Country News has an interesting article. They say, last week a jury, and this was dated August 31st, so it's fresh. Last week a Vegas jury, acquitted two men, Ricky Loveline of Montana and Stephen Stewart of Idaho, for their parts in the 2014 armed standoff between the federal government and supporters of rancher Cliven Bundy. The jury found co-defendants Eric Parker and Scott Drexler not guilty of most charges, but deadlocked on some. When it comes to trying the Bundys and their supporters, federal prosecutors now have a terrible record, winning just two convictions after two trials of six defendants in Nevada this year. Last fall, Bundy's sons, Ryan and Ammon Bundy, and five others were acquitted for leading an armed takeover. It wasn't a takeover. It was a
protest.
It was a protest where they were occupying. People could come and go. You know, this is. I don't like the verbiage here, but
well,
anyway,
they use that verbiage intentionally so that they can claim they're domestic terrorists.
Yeah, the recent acquittals in the Nevada case raise big questions for prosecutors. Some legal experts say the nation's current political climate, characterized by distrust of federal authorities, may help explain the acquittals. In some ways, the government itself, along with the defendants, went on trial in the Vegas courtroom. In 2014, a court ordered the federal government to round up Bundy's cattle, and we know the backdrop. They say many outside observers assume the Bundys or their armed supporters would get prison time. Even friends of Bundy and other ranchers with similar disdain for federal land agencies told me in 2014 that they thought the Clark County rancher had gone too far. But the Bunkerville trials have revealed the depths of the Americans' distrust in federal authority. The recent verdict was not a result of jurors' sympathy for the Bundys. Loveline's attorney, Sean Perez, concluded after speaking with them after the trial, he says, I think most of the jurors thought Cliven Bundy is an idiot for not paying the grazing fees. Instead, Perez credits the prosecutors' failure to prove their case as well as their overreaching tactics during the trial. This is not a rogue jury. What is a rogue jury? There's no such thing as a rogue jury. But he says this is not a rogue jury. It is a failure of truth on the part of the government. And they go on to talk about the things that they've been doing in this Anna Navarro, or Gloria Navarro, in the courtroom. The most recent trial, which was a retrial after the first jury deadlocked, was marked by a persistent push-and-pull dynamic between the defense team and the U.S. District Court, Judge Gloria Navarro. The defense tried to describe their client's state of mind and motivations behind the standoff. Navarro repeatedly barred them from doing so, saying it was irrelevant to the charges. I think the jury knew within the first few days that the judge was kind of cutting off the defense, Perez says. Even during opening statements, the government was objecting. It was at that point, 3 days into the trial, that the jurors realized they're only going to get half the story. In the final days of the trial, Navarro kicked Parker off the stand because he would not keep his statements within her court orders. Attorneys and observers were shocked into silence, and Parker returned to his seat, buried his hands in his head in his hands, and apparently began to cry. There's a philosophy among some defense attorneys that it plays to their advantage if it looks as if they're not getting a fair trial because everything they're trying to do is being shut down by the prosecutor or the judge. Nevada U.S. Attorney Richard Parker says. He says, I suppose in today's environment in which our institutions are questioned and challenged for more than 25 years ago, some attorneys believe it has a better chance of succeeding. Anyway, they go on to talk about the frustrations of different people who were observing the trial, but jurors' questions were not being answered. They requested more information, and much of the information that they were requested was denied. So, if I'm a juror and I'm trying to look at this objectively, and I don't know maybe everything about the case, but I'm getting the sense that I'm not getting the whole story, and so I request additional information, and they say, sorry, you can't have that information, what do you think I'm going to do? If I'm halfway intelligent and objective. Well, you know, if I can't get the information I want, then screw you, prosecution. I'm deciding for the defense. And that's exactly what's going on here. Even the jurors, God bless them, have enough of a pulse to see the railroading that's going on here.
Well, the prosecution introduced, video evidence, but they cut out the sound. Unless it, in all cases except when it was favorable to the prosecution, and they wouldn't let the defense put in anything. Yeah, the judge barred any kind of defense at all for those guys.
Yeah, because this was political.
Mm-hmm.
This is totally political.
Absolutely was.
We have to make an example of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make an example, and I don't care what you have to do, Navarro. You make sure you get a conviction. She might have even been threatened.
It's possible.
Whether
it's
she was possible. Promised something, or whether she was threatened, or maybe both.
Well, there's some kind of conflict of interest. I can't remember exactly what it was, but her husband is an attorney, too. And he was involved in maybe... And don't quote me on this, because I could be wrong, but I think he was involved in that land deal with Harry Reid.
Mm.
And Harry Reid owns property right around the Bundy Ranch. So
yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
A whole lot more to the story than I think even we know, besides the regulatory racketeering.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. But we have all this going on, and why isn't the administration stepping in and doing something about this? It isn't like this hasn't been a high-profile event. But with all the smoke and mirrors and all the rhetoric and all the media backlashing against Trump and all this back and forth, what gets lost is the truth. What gets lost is things that really matter, substantive things that prove whether or not the administration is genuinely sincere about freedom.
Yeah, no,
and this police state.
I think that's long gone. I think the Department of Justice is so corrupt at this point that I don't think there is any such thing as real justice in this system.
And what's going on? I come back to Soros, and I come back to these goons in masks. Terrorizing people, in various places, including the campus of Berkeley.
KPIX5's Joe Vasquez is in Berkeley, where the police chief is concerned about today's influx of anarchist protesters. Joe?
Hi, Juliet. You can see behind me, the barricades are still up, but the action is long over. You know, you had two sides in this action today. It was very lopsided. On one side, you had a very small group of right-wing demonstrators, and then you had thousands of counter-protesters who were, for the most part, peaceful until it got a bit ugly as some of the counter-demonstrators chased the demonstrators here in the streets and attacked them.
You have been outed as a neo-Nazi.
Tensions grew throughout the day from loud shouting.
No Trump! No KKK! No fascist USA!
To punching.
Hey! Whoa!
Hundreds of police officers barricaded the park, protected the tiny group of right-wing demonstrators as the much larger crowd of left-wing counter-demonstrators pushed in and grew larger. And then, around 1 o'clock, a dramatic scene. A large group marched up out of nowhere. At least 100 people wearing all black. They called themselves Antifa, which stands for anti-fascist. As the crowd turned their anger toward police, the chief says he made the tactical decision to abandon the park.
By 1 o'clock this afternoon, I don't know if we had 10 of the folks from the original protest and thousands of people for counter-protesters. And the question has to be, does it make sense to get into a major use of force over grassy area?
Antifa counter-demonstrators set off a purple smoke bomb, a signal to push aside barricades and move in. They took the park over, flew the flag of anarchy, and celebrated. Police escorted the right-wing demonstrators to the edge of the park. That's where counter-demonstrators pounced on them, chased them down the street. This guy took cover behind police lines.
I'm not here for violence, so of course I'm going to run to the police to guarantee my safety.
Trump supporter Arthur Schaefer, seen here earlier in the day, became a target later on. A mob chased him for a block and a half, took his flag, Trump hat, and glasses, and spat all over him.
You know, I'm okay with people making white supremacists feel unwelcome.
Now listen to this moron. Okay? I'm okay with all this that's going on.
You know, I'm okay with people making white supremacists feel unwelcome. I mean, excuse me, like, you're making me feel unsafe in my own country because I'm a Jew, and I'm like, what does this mean for our society?
Yeah, like anybody, who's attacked you, lady? Who's attacked you? What person has done anything to make you feel threatened?
But not everyone was thrilled to see such a large group of black-clad, masked anarchists, some of whom participated in the violence.
Their appearance is troubling for a number of reasons, but especially when I see them mixed in with community organizers and folks in our community who are not violent. And as far as I'm concerned, there's some deep discussions that need to happen within our community about providing space for Antifa.
Police arrested 13 people today, and one officer was injured during one of those
13.
Arrests. Six others, demonstrators, were also hurt, Juliet.
Joe, you witnessed it all. It looked really dramatic from what we saw, but where does this demonstration fit with all the other incidents at Berkeley this year?
Well, there were a couple of marked differences. For the most part, the other demonstrations, the police officers did not have the numbers. They did not have enough police officers to keep the fighting from happening. Today, we saw a very aggressive police force step right in and make arrests quickly. You did see some of that sort of, if you want to call it, mob rule as people were chasing people down the street and hitting them, but the cops were able to get in and rescue those folks pretty quickly as well. The other marked difference was Antifa. Huge numbers today, Juliet. More black-clad demonstrators than we have ever seen in the last decade or so. And so that made a huge difference as well here on the streets of Berkeley.
Yeah, Joe Vasquez in Berkeley. Joe, thank you.
Okay, so where are these people coming from? You know, we know...
Universities.
Well, these aren't students, though. As a matter of fact, let me just go ahead and play this. This was an interview by one of the people that were victimized, or at least attacked. Luckily, they weren't... She wasn't physically injured, but there is a guy from Campus Reform who is on here, and he's talking about some of who these people really are.
So tonight to this now, an out-of-control scene in Berkeley when dozens of black-clad anarchists tore through the barricades and assaulted pro-Trump attendees. It was peaceful up until then. U.S. Berkeley Republican Ashton Witte was in that crowd, and she fled the scene when it became violent. She was targeted then at a gas station minutes later.
What's up?
We're hungry for
supremacy. We got rough in there, huh? You got
we're real hungry for supremacy, huh?
We're not.
Then there's more of us.
You guys are all racist.
Joining me now, Troy Worden, UC Berkeley student and correspondent for CampusReform.org, and Ashton Witte, Berkeley College Republican and target of yesterday's violence. Welcome. Good to have you guys here today. So, Ashton, why were you there in the first place, and what happened to you?
Well, I felt it was my duty as an American to attend this rally and speak for my freedom of speech. I feel like it's something that is being threatened, you know, in America today, and I felt like if I went peacefully and just said what I had to say and had discussions with people, everything would be
fine.
What
did you have to say?
However,
what was on your mind?
Just
notice that we're here?
I wasn't discussed anything. I held up a poster that said, let's just have a conversation. And I had conversations with many interesting people, both Republican and Democrat, and everything was great until Antifa showed up. Antifa, they came with black masks, they carried weapons, they were pounding people down with their fists and their feet, and I knew I had to get out of there, so I contacted someone I knew who came to the rally. I got out of there, you know, by car. We drove down to safety. They asked me what happened. They filmed me, and I look over, and there's a woman on her phone, and she's texting, and she's staring us down. 2 minutes later, these guys show up. They start threatening us. They hit the car with some lead pipes. They're cussing at us, telling us we're dead men, that there's more of them. I find out then that Antifa actually had several people posted around Berkeley tracking us, and telling people our location by social media.
Yeah, I mean, it's frightening, and we look at the anger on their faces, and the videos of all of this that I watched today are just pretty incredible. So, Troy, who are these people? Are they from the Berkeley campus? I mean, you look at them, and they've got masks over their faces, and they're hiding their identity, and they're slapping people and hitting them with sticks. Where are they coming from?
Well, you know, Martha, I think it's unfortunate that so many news publications have refused to cover this growing and pressing issue. If we look at who are doing these attacks, who are stomping conservatives on the...
Now listen to this.
But six, the aftershock...
Hold on.
...ground and blooding them. They are mostly non-students. There are actually violent gangs coming up from Oakland, conscripted by Antifa, to hunt Republicans in the streets. Make no mistake, this is a pressing issue, and it needs more coverage. Luckily, campus reform has helped bring this story to light, and people are waking up. If you look at the petition signed by over 250,000 people calling on the federal government to recognize Antifa for what it is, a domestic terrorist organization, you'll see that, again, no one is fooled. We know exactly who is doing this. These anti-fascist organizations are conscripting violent criminals to basically make it impossible to be a conservative on a liberal campus. It's a sad day when students, just to stand up for what they believe in, have to face the very real possibility of severe injury or even death. And I just want to call out the mayor of Berkeley and the chancellor of the university. I want to tell them that you should stop telling the police to stand down and protect all Americans, regardless of their political ideology.
Well, they arrested 13 people, so we're going to keep an eye on it. I imagine that you guys will at Campus Reform as well.
Okay, I'm going to get out of that. The point is that they're not people from the campus. They're from outside the campus. Where are they coming from? Now, there's a website, crowdsondemand.com, and I think people need to be paying attention to crowdsondemand.com. Am I saying that they're participating in this? I don't know if they're participating in this, but I know that this is a rent-a-mob type of deal here. And how many of these companies out here have rent-a-mob that's being offered and hired and employed by somebody to do this? These people just show up. Anybody that organizes any event, I don't care who you are, you organize an event, you want a big turnout, okay? You know how difficult it is to get people to show up organically for anything. Mm-hmm. How difficult it is. It's nearly impossible. You're fighting an uphill fight. Yet all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you get all these flash mobs show up beating the hell out of people with sticks, with nails sticking out of them.
Yeah. I mean, hell, they could be Teamsters.
Well,
you know,
they could be anybody. But the thing is somebody's funding this big time. And you have this website, Crowds on Demand. Are you looking to create a buzz anywhere in the United States? At Crowds on Demand, we provide our clients with protests, rallies, flash mobs, paparazzi events, and other inventive PR stunts. These services are available across the country in every major U.S. city, every major U.S. metropolitan area, and even most smaller cities as well. We provide everything, including the people, the materials, and even the ideas. You can come to us with a specific plan of action, and we can make it happen. Or you can approach us with a general idea, and we can help you plan the strategy, then execute it. We've made campaigns involving hundreds of people come to action in just days. We have a proven record of delivering major wins on even the toughest campaigns and delivering phenomenal experiences with even the most logistically challenging events. Our services are now available throughout the United States, so whether you're looking at doing a single event or a multi-city campaign, we have the resources to achieve your goals. Now, what do you think of that?
I think that whenever you see a big crowd, that it has to be looked at with suspicion.
Highly
suspicious.
Because
it is extremely hard to get people out to anything.
Exactly. Whether your organization is lobbying to move forward a healthcare, financial, or other social initiative, We can organize rallies and get media attention for your causes and candidates. We'll also assist individuals, companies, and political organizations with protests and picketing campaigns. By the way, this is why you don't want a democratic government. This is why you don't. Why the United States is not a democracy under the Constitution, because of this very type of thing. We've protested governments, corporations, and everything in between. We've achieved results on campaigns on everything from ending institutional discrimination in a religious organization to getting refunds and compensation for hundreds of homeowners who bought hazardous land from a real estate firm to forcing a patent trolling company to back down. Some of these campaigns are long and drawn out, while others can be resolved quickly. Regardless, we endeavor to deliver campaigns that bring out the best qualities of our clients' messages and to achieve tangible results. They say a foreign government hired crowds on demand to help generate a positive reception for its newly elected leader during the UN General Assembly. The concern was ensuring that the leader was well-received by a U.S. audience and confident for his work at the UN. We created demonstrations of support with diverse crowds. We also used the media, primarily local and national outlets, to bring more attention to these demonstrations, which led to a mostly positive portrayal. The crowds that we deployed drew in more supporters, creating a strong presence for this leader at the UN and an improved perception of him by the American public.
Yeah, it's not bad enough they have to hire shills, that, you know, domestic shills. Now they're hiring them for foreigners.
Yeah, get a load of this. This guy who, Adam Stewart, is the CEO. Now, they admit here that his background, before starting Crowds on Demand, Adam worked as a reporter for AOL's patch sites, in product management positions at various Bay Area startup companies, and as a political organizer for campaigns including Jerry Brown's successful election as governor of California.
Oh, huh.
In 2010. Gee, you think that he might have organized some fictitious crowds for the good governor?
Jerry?
Ew, man. Anyway.
I don't know who would come out to see him, actually, unless they were paid.
Well, maybe some would, but I'll tell you what, after they see the big crowd, hey, this guy must be good. Anyway, we got to go. We're unbelievably out of time. But there's another article in the Atlantic. 1-800-HIRE-A-CROWD, the business of generating fake enthusiasm from flash mobs to the campaign trail. Amazing. Comes out. The truth always ends up coming out, despite their best efforts to squash it. We gotta go. Thanks, Vicki.
Thank you, Darren.
Pray for this republic. Do what you can to restore it. God bless you, folks. Keep your chin up, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.